From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our topic on this edition of the program, countering terrorist threats around the globe. Our guest, Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a distinguished think tank based here in Washington. And per the website, she focuses on the global Salafi jihadi movement and counterterrorism. Catherine also studies the Al-Qaeda network and related trends in the Middle East and Africa, including Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and Al-Qaeda in the Sahel. Catherine Zimmerman is also an advisor to AEI's Critical Threats Project and has testified before Congress about the threats to U.S. national security interests emanating from Al-Qaeda and its network. And most importantly, Catherine is no stranger to the VOA microphones. She is a frequent and valued guest on Encounter, especially regarding the conflict in Yemen. So today we are delighted to welcome her as our sole guest on Press Conference USA on the 21st anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, the anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as well as its growing malign influence in fostering extremist groups and authoritarian regimes in Africa, there is certainly no shortage of topics for us to discuss. And Catherine Zimmerman joins us via Microsoft Teams. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Carol, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Catherine, at this time of year, we usually reflect on the 9/11 2001 terror attacks on U.S. soil. We just commemorated the anniversary. After 21 years, what is the state of Al-Qaeda, which perpetrated the attacks?
Al-Qaeda today is really degraded in terms of its ability to conduct transnational terror attacks against the United States and its allies. What that means is that our 20 plus years of targeting this organization globally has been successful in defeating the terrorism threat. The challenge that we see, however, is that Al-Qaeda itself as an organization on the ground has strengthened and spread across the world from Africa all the way back into Afghanistan. And most worrisome is the return of sanctuaries for this organization. It's those sanctuaries that really enabled Al-Qaeda to plan and coordinate the 9/11 attacks 21 years ago.
Well, that's a very good point when you mentioned the return of sanctuaries, because we just saw that recently in Afghanistan with the takeover of the Taliban. How much has it, the Taliban takeover, emboldened Salafi jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda?
It's emboldened Al-Qaeda significantly, and not just Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but across the world. So what we saw when the Taliban took over a year ago is echoes of victory from places in Somalia with Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda's affiliate there, in the Sahel with a group that goes by the acronym JNIM, that is Al-Qaeda's branch in Western Africa. And this idea that the patient strategy the Taliban had used in Afghanistan, slowly eating away at the American and Western will to fight and commit resources against them, was successful. Now, it's not just one that is enabling the movement writ large globally, but it's also a case where the Taliban's return strengthened Al-Qaeda back in Afghanistan. The Taliban released detainees from all of the prisons inside of the country. That includes top operatives that have been in prison for over a decade. They're senior Al-Qaeda leaders back on the streets inside of Afghanistan today. Additionally, the group had been really quiet from the senior leadership in 2019, 2020, 2021. And the reason is because of the American counterterrorism pressure on the top leadership. They were literally afraid for their lives. And over the past year, while the Taliban has held Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda has put out so many more statements trying to rally support to its global jihad and bringing the inspiration for its cause for terrorism back to the forefront. And we can readily see that and how safe Al-Qaeda felt by the fact that its late leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was inside of a very prosperous, comfortable neighborhood in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul.
That is exactly what is so astounding, that the Taliban brazenly gave sanctuary to Ayman al-Zawahiri. He was in Kabul, and it illustrates what you said, that the victory in Afghanistan has reverberated throughout this Salafi jihadi movement. Let me ask you about the fact that the United States did eliminate Ayman al-Zawahiri. They located him in Kabul. This was this so-called over-the-horizon strike, seen as a success by the Biden administration, saying that it illustrated that Washington can do counterterrorism without a large footprint. So let's talk about the elimination of Ayman al-Zawahiri, to what extent that affects the ability of al-Qaeda to continue spreading throughout the world. Define also what the term over-the-horizon counterterrorism means, and do you think it is effective or not?
A lot of questions there, and let me try and parse them a little bit, starting with what it means for us to have taken out Ayman al-Zawahiri. Certainly, it was a major success for the Biden administration and for the United States to hold this al-Qaeda leader to justice. It really is a fact that when we take out terrorist leaders, it disrupts the organization globally. It causes them to have to spend time on internal affairs. There is an opening now for affiliates to potentially realign, which is actively being discussed inside of Syria and causing some dissension among the ranks. And we have proven that we can track down these individuals no matter where they are. All of that being said, however, it is not a demonstration that the over-the-horizon strategy that we are now pursuing against al-Qaeda and the Islamic State is successful. When we look at the resources required to go after Ayman al-Zawahiri, they were significant. It looks like intelligence identified where Ayman al-Zawahiri was in about April of this year, and then it took 3 to 4 months to plan a very precise operation to ensure that we were able to kill him and nobody else, including his family, inside of the house. That's precision targeting, and that is an array of planning resources that went to track down and kill one single man. I doubt that we're going to do that for an individual who ranks lower than Ayman al-Zawahiri, or he hasn't been on the battlefield the way that he has been for over 30 years. The second point is the choice of a drone strike versus a counterterrorism raid, like the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, wasn't really available to the United States because we don't have the footprint that we did in 2011. It was simply too risky to put U.S. Special Operations Forces on the ground inside of Kabul to go after Ayman al-Zawahiri. So the intelligence cache, the documents and the files that Osama bin Laden was sitting on that we recovered after the Abbottabad raid that allowed us to then go after the rest of the top leadership network in 2011 and 2012 was not available to us. The problem with drone strikes is that we actually don't get that much information after we use them. So while we might think that they are successful in terms of being able to kill single individuals, I really don't think that this over-the-horizon counterterrorism approach is going to sustain the pressure necessary on a global and resilient organization to ensure that it doesn't come back.
Well, thank you for that critique, Catherine. And as you have said in other writings, quote, we cannot kill our way to victory. And al-Qaeda is gaining support among local communities, as you alluded to, tapping into local grievances. They're exploiting vulnerable populations, providing services that official governments do not. So the question then is, what is a better alternative to the over-the-horizon counterterrorism strategy? What are complementary policies that you think the Biden administration should be implementing, or is it implementing other strategies to complement that?
The major issue with our approach to combating al-Qaeda is that we've adopted a purely counterterrorism approach. And that critique is a little bit nuanced. What it means is that our activities against al-Qaeda are focused on its ability to conduct terrorist acts. It's why we care that al-Qaeda exists. But when you study the organization, as you referred to, Carol, the way that al-Qaeda operates on the ground is much more like an insurgency. It's embedding itself within local communities and really gaining strength from these relationships with vulnerable populations. And the kinetic option that we have chosen, the security approach, using either our special forces or local partners to fight al-Qaeda and to fundamentally defeat it militarily, has has been incredibly ineffective over the past 20 years, but it's an approach that we're apparently doubling down on as a sustainable one going forward. Instead, what I'm looking to see from our government is finding a way to actually integrate our strategy against groups like Al-Qaeda and our efforts to advance other American interests, be it in parts of Africa where we see Russia and China gaining ground and influence with local actors. We have drawn back our counterterrorism assistance, but if we were to rethink the approach and start foreign assistance programs that target some of the governance issues that strengthen the state and that are not simply looking to kill the terrorists, we could actually start to kill two birds with one stone and make our money go a little bit farther. There's some efforts underway that have been in place for many years now that are running in the background that would be perfect for the Biden administration to elevate. It's the implementation of a piece of legislation, U.S. law now, called the Global Fragility Act, which is looking at using stabilization assistance in places like the Gulf of Guinea, in Mozambique, and elsewhere to prevent the spread of extremism further. So fundamentally to enable the local states to have resilience to extremist efforts to penetrate them.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Catherine Zimmerman. She's a fellow in counterterrorism at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also listen to the program on any of your favorite podcast apps. Please follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel and connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a new Facebook fan, Alhaji Bangura from Waterloo, Sierra Leone. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our terrific guest, Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. So, Catherine, we've been talking about Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, but what about IS, the Islamic State? From what I understand, they're competing with each other. IS developed after Al-Qaeda. Talk about that rivalry and to what extent that rivalry may be an obstacle to the development of either one's activities. We're seeing it also manifest itself quite vividly in Afghanistan. We have Islamic State in Khorasan and then Al-Qaeda. Talk about that relationship.
So the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda still see themselves at odds over the way forward for jihad. Fundamentally, the argument is over who they align with on the ground, what they're permitted to do. This is a question of which Muslim civilians they can kill, and really whether they start to build the state immediately, like the Islamic State did inside of Iraq and Syria, or whether it is a much more gradual process, as we've seen in places like Mali and Niger, where Al-Qaeda linked groups have slowly started to implement these bits and pieces of Islamic law in societies. The global competition has really been muted, however, and part of that has been because of the pressure on the Islamic State, because the United States and its partners have so efficiently degraded the leadership inside of Iraq and inside of Syria. It means that the core senior leadership of the Islamic State is under pressure from Iraqis, Syrian Kurds, and the U.S. and our Western partners. But what we're broadly seeing is the Islamic State is still slowly creeping back inside of spaces in northeastern Syria. There are, of course, troubles with the ongoing detention centers and, frankly, the refugee camps in northeastern Syria that remain little pockets of Islamic State territory where, within the camps, it is governed under Islamic law because many of these strong factions actually believe in the Islamic State's ideology. And there are problems both there and in the detention center with continued radicalization. The U.S. and others still haven't solved what to do with the foreign fighters that are now there. and with particularly the children that have grown up in this governance under the Islamic State and know no other life. The other challenge is that the Islamic State is gaining traction very quickly in parts of Africa, in part because it's been able to adapt to the various local networks and align its interests with those of some other criminal smuggling groups, but also because the counterterrorism partners are really not that strong in Western Africa, mostly because it has not been a priority for the United States. We've prioritized Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria, and Yemen, and then, of course, Somalia. And because the French just withdrew from that space, which has created a huge vacuum in terms of security and leads to a series of questions about whether there will be ongoing international engagement in that space. And finally, Afghanistan. Not only did Al-Qaeda benefit from the Taliban's takeover a year ago, but the Islamic State certainly did. The same thing happened with its fighters coming out of prison, but also it's been able to rally additional support from within the Afghan population. It is targeting sectarian fissures within Afghan society, going after Hazara Shia and creating challenges for the Taliban to govern. It is really testing the ability of the Taliban to secure Afghanistan, forcing this formerly insurgent opposition group to have to now police, which is very different from what it was doing for the past 20 years against U.S.-backed forces inside of the country. And the Islamic State, Khorasan in Afghanistan, has started to expand its attacks into Pakistan, into Uzbekistan and other neighboring states, growing regionally. And all of this is happening without significant counterterrorism pressure to keep it from happening because the United States does not have a counterterrorism partner inside of Afghanistan. We don't have access to the region. And the security dynamics are such that the Islamic State and others are able to really push on some of the weaknesses of the U.S. counterterrorism strategy to grow and strengthen.
Well, Catherine, I don't know about my listeners, but I learned an enormous amount from what you just said. We thank you for enlightening us with regard to the Islamic State, whether in Syria or, as you just mentioned, in Afghanistan and now pushing into Pakistan. I guess Pakistan is going to rue the day that they fully backed the Taliban over the government that fell, but that's a topic for perhaps another day. Let me turn now to the impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. To what extent do you think this unprovoked invasion has contributed to instability elsewhere and given succor to extremist groups and even authoritarian governments that might make right?
The Russian invasion of Ukraine has certainly contributed to developments elsewhere for a few reasons. The first is, of course, that the war in Ukraine has stopped the global food supply and fuel. And the places that relied on Ukrainian grain include East Africa and Yemen and places that already were food insecure and entering a year where the UN World Food Program was talking about the possibility of famine. Add the stress of war on top of that and disruptions in the food supply, and people literally are dying of starvation inside of Somalia. But the numbers are much higher, and it enables al-Shabaab to try to capitalize on efforts to provide assistance relief to various populations who don't see their government able to provide for them. The second part of this has been the effect of the war in Ukraine on European and American attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. It's accelerated this process that began years ago as the United States announced that it was pivoting to Asia, that it was engaging in this great power competition with Russia and China, and that we were going to be drawing down and deprioritizing counterterrorism. Now, we should be deprioritizing counterterrorism, but not to the extent where we ignore the risks that we are taking. What has happened, though, is every single element of the U.S. government has had to react to what's happening inside of Ukraine, and it has meant that they are unable or, in some cases, unwilling to take action when they see events happening elsewhere in the world that has given some of these groups, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, a little bit freer rein in terms of what they're able to do on the ground. And then, of course, the third bit, it's unclear how much this has actually been able to affect the strength of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, but there is a narrative that's occurring. The idea is that the United States simply doesn't care about people inside of Africa or the Middle East or Afghanistan, And the comparison is being drawn between how the U.S. treated the Afghan refugees after the collapse of Kabul in August of last year and the open arms that occurred as Ukraine fell into conflict and the treatment that Ukrainian refugees have gotten in the United States in particular. It's a narrative that has been built, but of course, it's still new, so it's not clear how much that has affected the ability of these groups to recruit.
On that same theme, as we pivot to Africa, we are seeing, for example, interference by the Russian-affiliated Wagner group. They seem to be sort of trying to fill the vacuum that the French left when their troops departed. As you mentioned, they ended Operation Barkhane in Mali. So despite efforts by Europe and the U.S. to combat terrorism in Africa and the affiliates of Islamic State, they are persisting. Recently, scores of civilians and soldiers were killed in Burkina Faso and Mali, presumably by what is called the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. So what is your sense of the situation in the Sahel and what effect is this having on instability in the region?
There are many complex dynamics that have fed into the counterterrorism challenges in the Sahel. The first and foremost is that France was the top partner for the United States in that region. And of course, there's a history of French colonialism, which means that the French relationship with the local governments was not always perfect. And that at times they actually felt as though they were again being subjugated to French will. The other challenge that is happening in Western Africa in particular, with a backsliding in terms of democratization and liberalization. So a series of coups and the rise of military officers and power and strength in the governments has really created issues both legally for the United States to work with some of these governments, but also in terms of who the partner on the ground actually is. When we look at how the U.S. was envisioning its counterterrorism approach inside of the African continent, it was going to prioritize Eastern Africa, where Al-Qaeda's affiliate Al-Shabaab has re-strengthened. We just saw the U.S. put troops back into Somalia after trying to pull back for a year. This is an affiliate that actually tried to plan a 9/11 style attack in the past couple of years, so it's got that global jihad mentality behind Al-Qaeda, and then to partner with the French and support them in terms of what they were doing in Western Africa, in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. That strategy collapsed when the French had to withdraw from Mali due to relations with the Malian government. And, you know, when we're looking at that dynamic in particular, it's not just that the French are gone. It's that the French air support is gone for the UN peacekeeping mission, which may lead countries who have put their troops in to Mali to perhaps think twice about whether they're going to recommit to deployments because they no longer have the medical evacuation capabilities that the French were providing. That includes the various European contingents that were also operating in the Sahel region. The French had organized, in addition to their own operation, a joint European operation that was bringing in some of the powers, Germany being one of them, to help fight this terrorist threat. And again, without the French overflights in Mali and the idea that there is a strong logistical backbone to ensure that their troops can make it out safely, these countries are starting to ask whether they need to be there in the first place and whether they can simply try and stop the threat at their southern borders. The last real challenge for the United States is simply the fact that the geography and the local dynamics are incredibly vast and complex. We're talking about an area of the world that is massive, hard to get across, very rugged terrain, sparsely populated, so really difficult in good times for the state to secure all of the borders and to ensure that there's no illicit activity ongoing inside of its territory. Add that a group that has arms and means to fight the state, and both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have been able to capitalize on the weaknesses and the peripheries of these various states in populations that have been underserved, that have been marginalized, and that frankly can't rely on any government whatsoever to come to their rescue.
Catherine, it's really a conundrum. As you said, the backsliding in democratization and the rise of the military has not helped at all. But we need to move to one more topic in Africa, and that's Al-Shabaab. al-Shabaab, and it's been conducting complex attacks in Somalia. Can you explain the reasons behind the rise in these attacks? And to what extent are you confident, or do you have any sense of optimism about bringing this conflict to an end in Somalia?
Al-Shabaab has been able to remain a threat inside of Somalia because fundamentally the political issues in Somalia's capital remain unresolved. There continue to be clan politics that divide the government and especially the security forces. There is disagreements over the distribution of resources between the capital and the various regions that it nominally controls, and even whether they should be under the capital itself. And the foreign assistance really isn't designed to strengthen the Somali state. It's been designed over the past decade to really focus on the security sector. So it has biased itself toward a military solution to a political problem on the ground. Al-Shabaab has risen in Somalia time and again because it is on the ground. It is able to provide governance. It provides better security than most of the various administrations in Somalia do. And it puts on an air that it's actually not corrupt. So its justice system is one that people go to, even though it is issuing rulings under Islamic law. They would rather have that than go to a government judge who can be bought off. The backsliding that we saw inside of Somalia occurred after the Trump administration decided to withdraw the small special operations presence that the United States had in the country that was working to advise, train, and support Somali special operations troops conducting counterterrorism raids, and reposition them within the region to kind of create distance between the threat in Somalia and our American troops. What that did was really break the relationships that we had on the ground, and it occurred at a time when the political maneuvering started to pull some of the troops away from their primary counterterrorism missions to supporting various political players. None of that breeds success in terms of fighting an enemy that's organized, and that is the space that Al-Shabaab came back in, and it, as you mentioned, it's now able to conduct these very complex attacks back inside of the capital that had, until recently, been relatively secure. The Biden administration's choice to put troops back inside of Somalia, it's about 500 special operations forces, has started to reverse some of the gains that Al-Shabaab had made, both in terms of being able to provide air support to target Al-Shabaab on the ground when it is close to the Somali army forces, but also just the ability to have that trust capital and relationship with our partners who are doing the fighting to ensure that they actually do the fighting that we want them to do.
Well, Catherine, very quickly, with regard to the continent and these extremist movements, whether al-Qaeda related or Islamic State, what role do you see for African states, whether it's ECOWAS or the Africa Union? Could they be more proactive in helping thwart these movements in addition to whatever Europe and the United States can offer?
Yes, they certainly do have a role. And part of it is going to be trying to shift the emphasis in terms of the strategies to defeat these groups from the securitized response that has been ineffective to one that actually deals with the sources of the local conflict that enables these groups to expand. It does mean that it will get messy in terms of politics and in terms of neighborly relations. I think the other part of this, though, is they're going to have to be quite vocal in terms of the support that they need from the West and why they need it, and ensuring that they don't get caught between the geostrategic competition that is ongoing, especially between the U.S. and Russia in some of these states. It is a particular challenge for Africa, where Russia and China look at the continent and they see its opportunities. They see that it is going to be the only continent, I believe, in the next 10, 20 years that has a growing younger population. It has a lot of potential, recognizing, of course, that the pandemic and the global downturn and global inflation are really affecting the economies of some of these countries. And on the flip side, the United States and particularly some of our European partners look at what's happening in Africa as a problem to be solved. So those are two very different perspectives. And I think that the African nations and some of the multilateral African bodies will need to better articulate both why they deserve American and Western support and how that support can be helpful in advancing both of our interests.
Catherine Zimmerman is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she specializes in the global Salafi jihadi movement. Catherine, I can't thank you enough for your time and your most invaluable insights on this very important topic.
Thank you so much, and I hope to bring good news at some point.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.